I feel like I've been sleepwalking for years, doing everything according to Mrs. Kendrick's way. Even in these last few weeks, even knowing we were under threat, I didn't strike out boldly enough. I didn't challenge anything. I didn't change anything. Well, today I have. Today it's been Sylvie's way, and Sylvie's way is quite different, it turns out. I've never called the shots here before, but today I've summoned Mrs. Kendrick and Robert for a meeting, and I've stipulated the time and place, and I've drawn up the agenda, and basically I'm in charge. I'm on it. I've been steely and focused all day. Okay, not all day. It would be more truthful to say I've been steely and focused in patches. Sometimes I've been concentrating on Willoughby House, and sometimes I've been checking my phone 500 times to see if Dan has texted, and trying his number another 500 times, and imagining what he must think of me, and imagining worst-case scenarios while my eyes fill with tears. But I can't afford tears now, so I've somehow put Dan from my mind. As I walk into the library, my chin is firm and my gaze is stern, and I can tell from the expressions of Mrs. Kendrick and Robert that they're both shocked at my appearance. "Sylvie!" Mrs. Kendrick gasps in horror. "You're..." "I know," I preempt her. "My hair." "Looks good," says Robert, and I shoot him a suspicious glance, but his face is impassive. Without any further niceties, I get out my scribbled notes and take up a position by the fireplace. "I've brought you both here," I say, "to discuss the future. Willoughby House is a valuable, uniquely educational museum full of potential, full of assets, full of capability." I put my notes down and look each of them in the eye. "We need to realize that capability, tap into that potential, and monetize those assets." Monetize is so not a Mrs. Kendrick word that I repeat it for emphasis. "We need to monetize our assets if we're to survive." "Hear, hear," says Robert firmly, and I shoot him a brief, grateful smile. "I have a number of ideas which I would like to run past you," I continue. "First, the basement has been criminally overlooked. I suggest an upstairs-downstairs exhibition, tapping into the fascination that people have with how the different classes used to live and work. Second, in the kitchen is an old housemaid's diary, itemizing her day. I rang up two publishers today, and both expressed interest in publishing the diary. This could link in with the exhibition. Perhaps we find the diary of her employer of the time and publish the two together." "That's inspired," exclaims Robert, but I carry on without pausing. "Third, we need to get more schools in and develop the educational side. Fourth, we need to get this whole place online. Fifth, we rent it out as a party venue." "A party venue?" Mrs. Kendrick's face drops. "Sixth, we hire it out as a movie set."
"Yes," Robert nods. "Yes."
"Seventh, we put on the erotica exhibit and make a media splash. And eighth, we focus our fundraising more tightly, because at the moment it's all over the place. That's it." I look up from my list.
"Well," Robert raises his eyebrows, "you've been busy."
"I know the condo merchants are circling," I appeal to him directly. "But can't we at least give this place a chance to become a modern, functioning museum?"
"I like it," says Robert slowly. "I like all your ideas. Although, again, money. Do not commit any money, Aunt Margaret," he adds quickly to Mrs. Kendrick as she opens her mouth. "You have done enough."
"I agree," I reply. "She has. And we don't need it." I can't help smiling at them both. "Because today, we were awarded a grant of £30,000 from the Wilson Cross Foundation." Susie texted me with the good news an hour ago, and I'll be honest, my initial reaction was, great, but is that all? I've been secretly hoping for a magical, problem-solving, fairy godmother amount, like another £500,000, but you have to be thankful for what you can get.
"Well done, Sylvie." Mrs. Kendrick claps her hands together. "Good work," agrees Robert.
"It'll tide us over," I say, "until some of these projects start generating income." Robert
holds out his hand with a list, and I pass it to him. He runs his eyes down it and nods a few times.
You'll spearhead all of this.
Can't wait, I nod vigorously. And I mean it. I can't wait to get cracking. I want to kick-start these projects and see them into fruition. More than that, I want to see them save Willoughby House. But at the same time, there's a weird feeling inside me that's been growing all day, a sense that my time here might be nearing its final stage. That I might sometime in the not-too-distant future move on to a new environment, challenge myself even more, see what I'm capable of. I catch Robert's eye and have the strangest conviction that he can tell what I'm thinking, so I hastily look away. Instead, I focus on the Adam fireplace with the two huge shells brought back from Polynesia by Sir Walter Kendrick. It's where we gather every year for Mrs. Kendrick's Sarf Christmas stockings. She wraps up little gifts and makes special marzipan cakes. I feel a sudden wrench. God, this place gets under your skin with all its quirks and traditions. But you can't stay somewhere just for the sake of tradition, can you? You can't stay put just for a few sentimental reasons. Is that how Dan feels about me? Am I a sentimental reason? My eyes start to feel hot again. It's been such a day, I'm not sure I can hold it together. If you don't mind, I'll be going, I say, my voice husky. I'll send you an email summarizing everything we've discussed. It's just, I think I need to get home. Of course, Sylvie, says Mrs. Kendrick. You go and have a lovely evening, and well done! She claps her hands together again. I head out of the library, and Robert comes along with me.
Are you okay?
He says in a low voice, and I curse him for being so perceptive. Yes, I say. Kind of. I mean, not really. I pause by the stairs, and Robert stares at me, as though he wants to say something else.
What did he do? He says at last.
And this is all so upside down I want to laugh, except it's not funny. What did Dan do? He worked tirelessly for my family with no credit, while I called him chippy and a fucking cliché, and drove him away. Nothing. He did nothing wrong. Nothing. Sorry, I start to walk again. I have to go. As I walk along our street, I feel numb, flat. All the adrenaline of the day has dissipated. For a while, I was distracted by the stimulation of doing stuff and achieving change and making decisions. But now that's all faded away. It doesn't seem important. Only one thing seems important. One person. And I don't know where he is, or what he's thinking, or what the future holds. I don't even have my girls waiting for me at home. If I did, I could hug them tightly to me and hear their little stories and jokes and troubles, read their books, cook their suppers, and distract myself that way. But they're at a birthday party with Karen. I'm walking along in a mist of preoccupation, unaware of my surroundings. But as I near home, I focus in dismay. There's an ambulance outside John and Owen's house, and two paramedics are lifting Owen out of it in a wheelchair. He looks frailer than ever, and there's a small plastic tube running into his nose. Oh my God! I hurry over to John, who keeps trying to put a hand on Owen's arm and is being firmly but gently batted away by the paramedics. What happened?
Owen is not well, says John simply.
There's almost a warning note to his voice. And I sense he doesn't want to be quizzed on what, how, when. I'm sorry, I say. If there's anything I can do, even as I say the words, they sound hollow. We all say them, but what do they mean?
You're very kind.
John nods, his face almost, but not quite, breaking into a smile.
Very kind indeed.
He follows Owen and the paramedics into the house. And I watch them, stricken, not wanting to be the nosy neighbor who stares, but not wanting to be the callous neighbor who turns away either. And as I'm standing there,
it occurs to me. There is something I could do. I hurry home, dash into the empty, silent kitchen, and start rooting around in the fridge. We had a supermarket order recently, and it's pretty full. And to be honest, I've never felt less like eating. I load up a tray with a packet of ham, a pot of guacamole, a bag of perfectly ripe pears, two frozen baguettes that just need 8 minutes in the oven, a jar of nuts left over from Christmas, a packet of dates also left over from Christmas, and a bar of chocolate. Then, balancing it on one hand, I head outside and along to John and Owen's house. The ambulance is gone. Everything seems very silent. Should I leave the tray on the doorstep and not disturb them? No, they might not realize it's there until it's tomorrow and the foxes have ripped it to bits. Cautiously, I ring the bell and form my face into an apologetic expression as John answers. His eyes are red-rimmed, I instantly notice. They weren't before. I feel a jab through my heart and want to back away instantly, leaving him in his private space. But I'm here now. And so I clear my throat a couple of times and say awkwardly, I just thought you might like... You might not have thought about food.
My dear, his face crinkles. My dear, you are too kind.
Shall I bring it in? Slowly I proceed through the house, afraid of disturbing Owen, but John nods toward the closed sitting room door and says,
He's resting.
I put the tray on the kitchen counter and the cold items in the fridge, noticing how bare it is. I'm going to get Tilda in on this too. We'll make sure they're permanently stocked up. As I finish, I turn to see that John seems lost in a reverie. I wait in wary silence, not wanting to break his thoughts.
Your daughter, he suddenly comes to. I believe she left a small rabbit. Small, white, large ears, he describes vaguely with his hands. Not a breed I recognize.
Oh, you mean her Sylvanian families?
I'm sorry, she leaves them everywhere. I'll fetch it for you.
Let me. I follow him out to his greenhouse, where, sure enough, one of Tessa's Sylvanian rabbits is standing incongruously by the rows of frondy plants. As I pick it up, John seems lost again, this time transfixed by one of the plants. And I remember something Tilda told me the other day. She said she'd Googled John, and apparently his research on plants has led to a breakthrough in gene therapy, which could help millions of people. I have no idea how that works, but there you go. It's an amazing life's work you've achieved, I venture, wanting to say something positive.
Oh, my work will never be done,
he says, almost as though amused. His face softens and he rubs a leaf between his fingers, lovingly.
These wonders will never reveal all their secrets. I've been learning about them ever since I was a boy. Every time I look at them, I learn a little more. And as a result, I love them a little more.
He moves a pot tenderly, patting its fronds.
Tiny miracles. Much like people.
I'm not quite sure if he's talking to me or to himself, but every word he says feels like a drop of wise potion. I want to hear more. I want him to tell me all the answers to life. I don't know how you... I break off, rubbing my nose, inhaling the earthy, greeny smell of the plants. You're very inspiring. Dan and I have... I swallow hard. Anyway, it doesn't matter about us. I just want you to know you're inspiring. 59 years. I look straight at him. 59 years loving one person. It's something. It's an achievement. John is silent for a few moments, his hands moving absently around his plants, his eyes far off with thought.
I am an early riser, he says at last. So I watch Owen wake up every morning, and each morning reveals something new. The light catches his face in a particular way. He has a fresh thought. He shares a memory. Love is
finding one person infinitely fascinating.
John seems lost in thought again, then comes to.
And so, not an achievement, my dear. He gives me a mild, kind smile. Rather, a privilege.
I stare back at him, feeling choked up. John's hands are trembling as he rearranges his pots. He knocks one over, then writes it, and I can tell he doesn't quite know what he's doing. I recall Owen just now, pale and shrunken, the tube in his nose, and have a sudden, horrible fear that it's bad. Really bad. On impulse, I grab John's shaky hands and hold them in mine till they're still. If you ever want company, I say. Help, lifts in the car, anything. We're here. He nods and squeezes my hands, and we go back into the house, and I make two cups of tea, because that's something else I can do. And as I leave, promising to return tomorrow, all I can think is, Dan. I need to talk to Dan. I need to communicate. Even if he's still in Devon, even if he has no signal, even if it's a one-sided conversation. As I get inside our house, I'm already reaching for the phone. I dial his number, sinking down onto the bottom step of the stairs, desperate to let him know, desperate to make him understand what. Dan, I say as the phone beeps, it's me. And I'm so sorry. I swallow, my throat all lumpy. I just... Oh, God, terrible. Why am I so bloody inarticulate? John, with all his worries, manages to sound like some elegiac poet, whereas I flounder around like an idiot. I click off, dial again, and start another voicemail. Dan, I swallow the lumps down. It's me, and I just called to say... No, I sound like Stevie Wonder. Bad. I click off and try again. Dan, it's me. I mean, you knew that, right? Because you saw Sylvie pop up on your screen, which means you're listening to a message from me, which I suppose is a good sign. What am I going on about? I click off before I can sound any more like a rambling moron and dial a fourth time. Dan, please ignore all those other messages. Sorry, I don't know what I was trying to say. What I am trying to say is... I pause, trying to untangle my thoughts. Well, I suppose it's that all I can think about is you. Where you are, what you're doing, what you're thinking. Because I have no idea anymore. None. My voice wobbles and I take a few seconds to calm myself. It's ironic, I guess, because I used to think I knew you too well, but now... A tear suddenly runs down my cheek. Anyway, above all, Dan, and I don't know if you're even still listening, but above all, I wanted to say... The door opens, and I'm so startled. I drop my phone in shock, thinking, Dan? Dan? But it's Karen, wearing sneakers and earbuds and her cycling backpack. Oh, hi, she says, looking surprised to see me sitting on the stairs. I forgot my iPad. Shit, Sylvie, your hair. Yes, my hair, I peer at her in confusion. But wait, aren't you supposed to be with the girls? Dan's with them, she says casually. Then at my reaction, her expression changes. Oh, wasn't I supposed to say? He just turned up and said he'd do the party. Dan's here. My heart is thudding so hard, I can hardly breathe. He's here. Where? Where? Battersea Park, says Karen, eyeing me weirdly. Climb on. You know, the climbing place. My legs are already moving. I'm scrambling to my feet. I need to get there. Chapter 17. Battersea Park is one of the reasons we like Southwest London. It's an amazing resource, huge and green and full of activities. It's a fine evening as I reach the gates, and people are out in force enjoying themselves. They're strolling, cycling, rollerblading, riding recumbent bikes, and hitting tennis balls. Everyone's relaxed and smiling at one another. But not me.
I'm desperate. I'm not smiling. I'm a woman on a mission. I don't know what's propelling me. Maybe some marriage-in-crisis superpower that causes all your muscles to explode in strength? But somehow I'm speeding along, past all the joggers, tottering in my black high heels, panting and red-faced. My lungs are on fire, and there's a blister on my heel, but the more it hurts, the harder I run. I don't know what I'm going to say when I see him. I'm not even sure I can string a sentence together. All I have is the odd random word landing in my brain as I run. Love, forever, please. Oh! Suddenly, without warning, I feel a massive jolt and crash to the ground, scraping my face painfully against the tarmac. Ow! Ow! I manage to get to my feet and see a little boy on a recumbent bike who has clearly just bashed into me and doesn't look remotely sorry. Sorry, a woman is running over. Josh, I've told you to be careful on that bike. She surveys me in dismay. Oh, dear, you've cut your forehead. You should see a medic. Do they have a first aid place? It's fine, I say hoarsely and start running again. Now she mentions it, I can feel blood running down my face. But whatever, I'll find a band-aid later. Climb On is a massive adventure playground for children, full of ropes, dangling ladders, and dangerous, hideous, swaying bridges. As it comes into view, the very sight of it makes my stomach turn. Why on earth would you have a party here? What's wrong with safe activities on the ground? As I get near, I can see Dan. He's standing on a bridge at the top of a tower with a couple of other dads all wearing safety helmets. But while the dads are joking about something, Dan seems oblivious to the party. He's staring ahead, his face shadowed, his brow taut. Dan! I yell, but the place is full of clamoring children, and he doesn't turn. Dan! Dan! I scream so loud that my throat catches, and still he doesn't hear me. I have no choice. Dodging past the entrance barrier and ignoring the cry of the attendant, I run at the structure, kick off my heels, and start climbing up a monstrous set of rope steps that will lead me to the platform that Dan is on. I'm not even thinking about what I'm doing. I'm just getting to Dan in the only way possible. And it's only when I'm about 10 feet off the ground that I realize what I'm doing. Oh, God. No. I can't. No. My fingers freeze around the ropes. I start to breathe more quickly. I look down at the ground and think I might vomit. Dan is another 20 feet up. I need to keep climbing. But I can't. But I have to. Hey! An irate voice is calling me from the ground. Who are you? Are you with a party? You need a helmet! Somehow I force myself up another step, and up. Tears have started to my eyes. Don't look down. Don't look. Another step. The rope steps keep wobbling perilously, and a whimper escapes from me. Sylvie? Sylvie? Dan's voice hits my ears. What the fuck? I raise my head to see him peering down at me incredulously. We need a manager, someone is saying on the ground. Gavin, your deputy manager, you climb up after her. I'm not climbing after her, an indignant voice replies. We're supposed to use the emergency ladder anyway. Jamie, get up the emergency ladder. Every sinew of my body is begging me to stop. My head is spinning. But somehow I push on, step after step, higher and higher, ignoring the fact that I'm 20 feet off the ground. 25 feet. That I don't have any harness or any helmet. That if I fall... No. Stop. Don't think about falling. Keep going. I'm aware of the atmosphere becoming quieter. Everyone must be watching. Are the girls watching? My hands have started sweating. My breath is coming in fast, harsh little gasps. Now the platform is only a few feet away. Only a few more steps will do it. But a new tremor comes over me. My legs are shaking so hard that I feel the hugest wash of fear I have yet. I can't control my limbs. I can't do this. I'm going to fall. I'm going to fall. How can I not fall? You're nearly there. Dan's voice is in my ears, solid, familiar, something to cling to mentally. You're nearly there, he repeats, You're not going to fall. One more step. Hand on the platform. Nearly there, Sylvie. Nearly there. And suddenly, I'm there. And his strong hand is grasping mine, and I'm collapsing on the wooden platform. And for a few moments, I can't move. At last, I raise my head to see Dan staring at me with such a scrumptious face that I want to laugh. Except I can't because tears are streaming down my face. What the fuck? He demands and grabs me so tightly I gasp. What the fuck? Sylvie, you could have... What were you doing? He stares at me looking quite aghast. I suppose I am quite an apparition. What with the shorn hair and the blood dripping down my face. Were you trying to surprise me? Or shock me? Or give me a heart attack? Is this real? He touches my cheek, and as blood comes away on his fingers, he looks even more shocked. Jesus Christ! I wasn't trying to surprise you. I manage, my breaths still short and fast. That's not what this is. I just had to see you. Didn't you get my messages? Messages? His hand goes automatically to his pocket. No, my phone's fucked. Sylvie, what is this? You can't do heights. He looks at the ground, 30 feet below, then at me. You can't even do a step ladder. Well, I rub my bloody face. Looks like I did them. But your face? Your hair? What's happened? Sylvie, what the hell? He turns ashen. Have you been attacked? No, I shake my head. No, I cut my hair off myself. Dan, listen, I know about... I have to get this through to him urgently. I... No. You... No. A familiar guarded expression comes across his face as though he's ready to bat away my questions. And in that moment I realize just how much he's been keeping from me. What a constant pressure it must have been. No wonder he's fed up. I know, okay? Believe me, I know. The other dads who were on the platform with Dan have tactfully headed off to the zip wire platform, where all the children, including our two, are clustering with play leaders in branded T-shirts. We're alone. What do you know exactly, Sylvie? Says Dan cautiously, and his willingness to protect me even now makes my eyes hot. I stare back at him, thoughts swirling around my mind. What exactly do I know? Nothing, it feels like, most of the time. I know that you're not the man I thought you were. I gaze into his guarded blue eyes, trying to get beneath the surface. You're so much more than I ever realized. My throat is tight, but I press on. I know what you've been doing, Dan. I know what all the secrets are. I know about my father, Joss Burton, the whole thing. I read the emails. I take a deep breath. I know my father was a liar and a shit. Dan visibly flinches and stares at me incredulously. What did you say? My father was a liar and a shit. There's silence as my words sit in the air. I've never seen Dan look so shocked. I don't think he can speak, but that's okay, because I have more to say. I've been living in a bubble. I swallow hard. A climate-controlled, safe bubble. But now it's burst, and the weather has blown in, and it's exhilarating. I can see, Dan nods slowly. Your face... It's different. Bad different. No. Real different. You look more real. He surveys me as though trying to work it out. Your eyes. Your expression. Your hair. I put up a hand and feel my bare neck. It still feels unfamiliar. Exposed. It feels like a new me. Princess Sylvie. Is dead, I say abruptly, and there must be something about my tone because Dan nods gravely and says, Agreed. I suddenly become aware of an extendable ladder being placed against the platform we're on. A few moments later, a guy in his 20s appears, holding a helmet. As he sees my bloody face, he recoils, aghast.
Did that injury happen on our premises?
He has a reedy voice and sounds freaked out.
Because you are not an authorized client. You have not undergone the health and safety briefing. You are not wearing approved headwear.
It's okay, I cut him off. I didn't injure myself on your premises.
Well,
he gives me a resentful look and holds out the helmet to me.
All clients must wear protective helmets at all times. All clients must register before using any apparatus and be fitted for a harness.
Sorry, I say humbly. I take the helmet from him and put it on.
Please descend from the apparatus, the guy adds in such a disapproving voice that I feel an involuntary giggle. Forthwith.
Forthwith? I glance at Dan and see that he's hiding a smile too. Okay, I say. I'm going. I eye the extendable ladder and feel a wave of nausea. In a minute. I can show you a gentler way down, Dan says to me. Unless you felt like hurling yourself down the rope ladder head first. Not today, I match his deadpan tone. Another time. I follow Dan across a rickety, ropey bridge to a lower platform. My legs are trembling violently in a kind of aftershock state. Every time I glance down, I want to heave. But I smile brightly at Dan whenever he looks round. And somehow, I keep going. And we make it. Vincit quisse vincit, keeps running through my head. She conquers who conquers herself. And then we descend an easier ladder. And pretty soon, we're on the ground. And I am really, really glad. In fact, I slightly want to hug the ground in gratitude. Not that I would ever admit this to anyone. Okay, Dan rounds on me. Now we're on the ground, and you're not going to fall off in fright. I'm going to say it again. What the fuck? His eyes are wide, and I realize he's genuinely freaked out. What happened to your face? Your hair? He's counting off on his fingers. How do you know about your dad? I'll leave you for 2 nights and all hell breaks loose. 2 nights? It feels like an eternity. I knew you were lying about going to Glasgow, I say, a familiar pain washing over me. I thought you'd gone to... I thought you were leaving me. You said you needed space. You said you needed to... escape. Oh, God. Yes, Dan closes his eyes. Yes, I didn't mean that. I just... He pauses and I wait fearfully. It was all becoming... He breaks off again, looking toward the sky. I can't finish his sentence in perfect, overlapping sync. Psychic Sylvie, who knew everything, has vanished. And now that the exhilaration of climbing up 30 feet has worn off, I can see us for what we are. A married couple from southwest London who have hit the buffers, trying to sort it out, finding our way. Not there yet. I know it's been an ongoing nightmare, I say at last. Mary Holland told me. Oh, nightmare is probably too strong, Dan rubs his face, looking suddenly weary. But it's endless. I have your mother on at me every day. Emails from the lawyers, Joss Burton's agent. This book is going to happen, and it's going to be huge. She's a big deal, Sylvie, and I'm not sure I can stop it this time. He looks so troubled. I should say something sympathetic, but my residual anger's too great, and I can't help rounding on him in turn. So why didn't you tell me? Because it's Dan who kept secrets, who drove wedges between us, who kept flicking to another page when I tried to read his whole story. You should have told me right from the start. As soon as my father came to you, you should have said, "We need to tell Sylvie." Then everything would have been different. I can't help sounding accusing. I've developed a whole alternate universe in my head where this is what happened, and somehow the situation made Dan and me stronger as a couple instead of nearly splitting us up. I should have told you, Dan stares at me incredulously, almost angrily. Sylvie, do you have any idea? Your father would have killed me for a start. The whole thing was a total secret from everybody. Even your mother didn't want to know. All we were trying to do, round the clock, was contain it, shut it down. Your father was after a knighthood, for God's sake. He was adamant that no one could know about this scandal, least of all his daughter. And he really meant it. Can you imagine what kind of rage he was in?
There's a pause, then silently I nod. I can still remember the white-hot fury that would come into Daddy's eyes. Not with me, never with his princess, but with others. And the idea of Daddy caged in by possible scandal. Yes, I can imagine.
And then, just when we were in the middle of it all, he had the crash. He was gone.
Dan stops abruptly, and I can see the remembered shock pass through him.
And there was no way I could have told you then.
Yes, you could, I say robustly.
That was the perfect time.
Sylvie, you couldn't cope as it was. Dan erupts furiously.
Do you remember what that time was like? Do you realize how worried I was? You were a bloody mess. If I'd come along and said, hey, guess what? You know your adored dad, the one you've gone into extreme grief over. Well, apparently he preyed on a 16-year-old girl. Or maybe he didn't.
Dan rubs his face hard.
I mean, Jesus. You were in meltdown. Your mum was on another planet. What was I supposed to do? What was I supposed to do?
He appeals to me directly, his face twisted up, as tentary as I've ever known it. And I can see years of strain in him. I can see all the decisions he's been wrestling with, all alone.
I'm sorry, I say, chastened. I know. You did what you thought was best, and I realize it was out of love for me. But Dan, you were too protective.
I can see Dan smarting at my words. All this time he's thought he was doing the right thing, the gallant thing, the best possible thing. It's hard to hear that it wasn't.
Perhaps, he allows after a pause.
You were, I insist. And we need to stop talking about my episode. We need to accept that grief happens. Shit happens. Life happens. And glossing over it or trying to say it's an illness isn't the way to go. Better to acknowledge it, cope with it, clear it up together.
I have a sudden image of Dan and me working together with brooms, side by side, hot and sweaty and determined. It's not the most romantic, hallmark image of marriage, but it's what I want us to be. I can see Dan digesting what I'm saying, or at least trying to. It'll probably take a while.
Fair enough, he says at last. Maybe you're right.
Then his face changes, becomes a little more tense.
Have you seen what she wrote?
Skimmed it, I say, looking at the ground.
The big question is sitting there, in the air, between us. I know he's never going to broach it, so I have to. I take a breath, gearing myself up, preparing myself for his answer, whatever it is.
Do you think it's true?
At once his face closes up again, like a clam.
Don't know, he says distantly. It's his word against hers. It's a long time ago. Probably not worth speculating.
But you've read everything she wrote. I peer at his face, trying to read it.
What do you think?
Dan looks even more tortured. I don't like talking about this with you.
It's sordid, I say flatly.
It's not what my family was supposed to be about. We were supposed to be the gilded, perfect ones, right? Dan winces but doesn't contradict me.
God, he's had a fucked up view of my family. Ridiculous brunches with Mummy, endless viewings of Daddy on that DVD, all golden and handsome, and all the while scrabbling around with lawyers to keep our dirty washing out of sight.
I'm going to read all the files, I say. Everything she's written, everything she's said. Every word.
Dan looks appalled. That's not a good idea.
I'm going to.
I cut him off.
I have to know. Don't worry. I won't flip out.
You know she was Lynn, I add, hunching my arms round my body. My parents lied to me.
I know. Dan grimaces. That was the worst bit of all, hearing you talk about your imaginary friend.
and knowing. He shakes his head. That was messed up. I felt guilty about Lynn my whole childhood. I felt ashamed and confused. And stupid. My jaw grows tight at the memory. And I will never forgive him for that. Never. I speak the words viciously, and look up to see Dan, regarding me anxiously. Sylvie, don't go overboard. Don't go too far the other way. I know this is all shocking, but he was still your dad, remember? You loved him, remember? I prod my feelings about Daddy. I wait for the familiar torrent of grief and love and fury that he's been taken from us. But there's nothing. It's as though the flow has been cut off at the mains. Maybe I did. I watch a guy on rollerblades in the park trying to go backward. Maybe I will one day again. That's all I can say for now. I shoot him a sidelong look. I never understood what went wrong with you and Daddy. Now I get it. I thought I concealed my feelings perfectly. Dan gives me a wry smile. Not so much. I return his smile, but inside, I'm rewinding over the years, back to when Dan discovered all this and got dragged into a side street of our family map that he was never expecting. It must have been awful for you. It wasn't great, says Dan, his eyes distant. I idolized your dad too, you know, in my own way. He was such a hero. So when these allegations came along, at first I was shocked. I wanted to defend him. I was glad to defend him. I actually thought it would be a way for us to become closer. Until he gives a humorless laugh. Well, let's just say we didn't. I've read his emails to you. I nod bleakly. I know. He didn't like that I'd seen beneath the glossy veneer, says Dan, slowly. He couldn't really stand it. The sound of shrieking heralds the children, who are being ushered off the apparatus and into a room decorated with balloons. As they pass by, both Tessa and Anna gasp at the sight of us, as though it's been several days since we saw each other.
Mummy! You got a hurt! Says Tessa. Just a tiny one, I call back. I'll get a band-aid and it will all get better. Look, that's my daddy. He's there.
Anna points at Dan, and all the children turn to gawp at us as though we're celebrities, despite the fact that they see us pretty much every day at school, and that all the other parents are here too. Should we go in with them? I say to Dan, my parental radar tweaking. Are we supposed to be at the tea? No. They'll be fine. We wave as they file into the party room. I can just about hear Tessa boasting,
My mummy always climbs up ladders.
And then look at each other, as though we're starting again. I feel like another layer has been stripped off. The guarded look has gone from Dan's eyes. As he meets my gaze, there's a new honesty in them. With every revelation, I understand Dan better. I learn more about him. I want to learn more about him. John's voice runs through my head.
Love is finding one person infinitely fascinating.
He's my man. My Dan. The sun in my solar system. And I know he used to be eclipsed at times by a bigger, showier sun. And maybe that was always our problem. But now I can't think how I ever compared Daddy to Dan, even in the privacy of my own brain, and found Dan lesser. Dan is my son. Dan wins on every count. Sylvie, Dan interrupts my thoughts, and I realize that tears are streaming down my face. Sorry, I gulp, brushing at my cheeks. Just thinking about, you know, us.
Oh, us.
His eyes lock onto mine, and again, there's that new truth to his gaze. An acknowledgement. It's a different connection. We're different. Both of us. So, what now? I venture at last.
68 years minus, What, a few weeks? Says Dan in unreadable tones. It's still a long time.
I know,
I nod. Bloody long time. I mean, geez.
Yep. Dan's silent for a moment, and I almost can't breathe. Then he looks up, and there's something in his eyes which makes my heart twitch and tangle up in knots.
I'm up for it if you are.
I am,
I nod, barely able to speak.
I am. I'm up for it.
Okay, then.
Okay.
Dan hesitates, then lifts his hand and gently touches my fingertips, and my skin starts fizzing in a way I really wasn't expecting. What's happened to my nerve endings? To me? Everything feels brand new, unpredictable. Dan starts nibbling my fingers, his eyes never leaving mine, and I stare back, transfixed, wanting more. Wanting to get a room. Wanting to rediscover this man that I love.
Sylvie! Dan! Are you coming in for tea?
A cheery voice hails us, and we both jerk round in shock to see the birthday girl's mother, a woman called Jill, waving at us from the door of the party room.
We've got nibbles for parents. Prosecco!
Maybe in a minute, calls back Dan politely. By which I mean, can't you see we're busy? He adds in a voice that only I can hear.
Don't be like that, I say reprovingly. She's offering Prosecco.
I don't want Prosecco. I want you. Now.
His eyes are running over me with a greed I haven't seen in years, an urgency that makes me shiver. He grips me by the hips, and he's breathing hard, and I think he would have me right here, right now. But we're in Battersea Park, at a children's party. Sometimes I think Dan forgets these things.
We've got another 67 years and some, I remind him. We'll find another moment. I don't want another moment.
He buries his face in my neck.
Dan! I bat at him. We'll get arrested.
Fine, he rolls his eyes comically. Fine. Let's go and drink our Prosecco. You could wash your face too, he adds, as we start slowly walking up the balloon-decorated path. Not that blood-stained zombie isn't a good look.
Or else I could scare the children, I suggest. I could be the slasher zombie clown.
I like it. He nods and reaches a hand to ruffle the hair at the nape of my neck. I like this too. I like it a lot.
Good.
A lot.
He can't seem to remove his hand from my shorn neck, and his voice has descended to a kind of dark growl, and I suddenly think, oh my God, was Dan a short-haired guy all the time? And I never even knew.
The girls hate it, of course, I tell him. Of course they do, Dan looks amused. And Mrs. Kendrick?
Hates it too. Oh, that's the other thing, I add. I'm thinking of leaving my job.
Dan stops dead and stares at me incredulously. Okay, he says at last. Where is my wife and what have you done with her?
Why? I meet his gaze head on, challenging. Do you want her back?
I have another image of the princess-haired, bubble Sylvie that I was. She already feels a lifetime ago. No, says Dan without missing a beat. You can keep her. This is the version I like.
Me too, I nod. He still can't keep his hands off my bare nape, and I don't want him to stop. My whole neck is tingling. My whole me is tingling.
I should have cut my hair off years ago.
We've reached the party building by now. I can hear the shrieks of children and the chatter of parents and all the conversations that will swallow us up as soon as we enter. Dan pauses on the doorstep, his fingers resting on the back of my neck, and I can see a deeply concentrating, scrumptious look pass over his face.
It's not easy, is it? He says heavily, as though coming to some almighty conclusion. Marriage. Love. It's not easy.
As he says it, Tilda's words come back to me, and they've never seemed so true. If love is easy, I hesitate, you're not doing it right. Dan looks down at me silently, and even though I'm not psychic Sylvie anymore, I can see emotions jumbling through his eyes. Old anger, tenderness. Love.
Well then, we must be fucking masters.
He pulls me to him and kisses me hard, almost fiercely, like a statement of intent, a vow almost. Then, at last, he releases me.
Come on, let's get that Prosecco.
Chapter 18. The house is all alone on a cliff, with huge glass windows framing the sea view, and a vast linen wraparound sofa, and beautifully scented air. I'm sitting on one end of the sofa, and Lynn is sitting facing me. Jocelyn, I mean. I know she's Joss. That's what I call her to her face, but as I stare at her, all I can think is, Lynn. It's like looking at a magic eye picture. There's Joss, famous Joss Burton, founder of Maze, who I've seen on book covers and in magazine articles, with her trademark white streak of hair and dark, intelligent eyes. And then, glimmering underneath, there's Lynn. Traces of my Lynn. In her smile especially. Her laugh. The way she crinkles up her nose in thought. The way she uses her hands when she talks. She's Lynn. My made-up Lynn. Come to life. Never imaginary at all. It's like seeing Father Christmas and my fairy godmother all wrapped up in one elegant, real-life woman. It's not the first time I've seen her as an adult. We met up for the first time a month ago, but I'm still finding it surreal, being here, being with her. I used to talk to you every day, I say, my hands wrapped around a cup of Maize chamomile tisane. I used to tell you my problems. I used to lie in bed and conjure you up and just talk to you. Was I helpful? Joss smiles in that way I remember. Warm and just a little bit teasing. Yes, I smile back. You always made me feel better. Good. More tea? Thanks. As Joss pours fresh tisane into my cup, I glance toward the stunning view of a cliff top giving way to endless, pale grey December sky with churning sea beneath. I'm deliberately testing myself, and to my own satisfaction, my heart remains quite steady. I've had a full course of therapy and lots of practice, and while I'll never be the type to dance merrily across a tightrope, I'm a lot better with heights now. A lot better. And I still see the counselor who helped me. Once a week, I knock on her door, looking forward to the session, knowing I should have done this years ago. Because it turns out, she's pretty good at talking about issues other than heights, like fathers, imaginary friends, old alleged affairs, that kind of thing. Of course, I've read everything now. First I read Through the High Maze, cover to cover, twice over, searching for clues, reading between the lines. Then I went into Avery Milton and read Joss's whole account of the episode with Daddy. It took a morning because I kept breaking off. I couldn't believe it. I wouldn't believe it. I did believe it. I hated myself for believing it. It was weeks before everything properly shook down in my head. And now I think, what do I think? I exhale as my thoughts describe the same circle they have done constantly, ever since that day I went to see Mary Smith Sullivan. I think Joss is a truthful person. That's what I think. Whether every single detail is accurate, I can't know. But she's truthful. Mary Smith Sullivan isn't as convinced. She keeps saying to me, it's her word against his. Which is right, and it's her job as a lawyer to protect her client, and I understand that. But the thing is, it's Joss's words which feel true. As I read her story, little details of what he'd said and how he'd behaved kept jumping out at me. I kept thinking, that's Daddy. And, yes, that's just how it was. And then I found myself thinking, how would our 16-year-old holiday neighbor know Daddy so well? And it led me, logically, to one place. I came to that conclusion 4 months ago, and went to bed feeling numb. I couldn't even talk to Dan about it. But the next day I woke up with total clarity, and before I'd even left for work, I'd written a letter to Joss. She phoned me up as soon as she got it, and we spoke for an hour. I cried. I'm not sure if she did, because she's one of those very tranquil people who have found their way through the maelstrom. That's a quote from Through the High Maze. But her voice shook. Her voice definitely shook. She said she'd thought of me a lot over the years. Then we met in London and had a cup of tea together. We were both nervous, I think, although Joss hid it better than I did. Dan said he was happy to come as moral support, but I said no. And actually, if he'd been there, I would never have had that amazing chat I did with Joss. She told me that Dan, all along, had been the one positive force in the whole matter. She said he'd persuaded her that the affair with my father wasn't necessary to the powerful story she was telling in Through the High Maze, and it might even detract. "Do you know," she said then, her eyes shining, "he was right. I know he was trying to defend your father, but he made a good point too. I'm glad I didn't make that book about my teenage self." There was a pause, and I wondered if she was about to say she wouldn't ever tell that part of her story, and I needn't worry any more. But then she pulled out a huge bound sheaf of papers, and I could see the wary look in her eye, and I instantly knew. "This is the proof of the new book," she said. "I want you to read it." And so I read it. I don't know how I did it so calmly. If I'd read it a few months ago with no warning, it would have freaked me out. I probably would have thrown it across the room. But I've changed. Everything's changed. "Sylvie, your last email troubled me," Joss says as she puts down the teapot. She has a way of talking which is very calming. She says something and then pauses and lets the words breathe, so you actually think about them. "Why? What exactly?" Joss cradles her own cup and gazes out to sea for a moment. She's calling her new book Into the Wide Open Air. And right now I can't think of a better title. "You seemed to be assuming culpability. Feeling guilt." She turns and fixes me with a clear look. "Sylvie, I am not saying, and I never will say, that your father caused my eating disorder." "Well, maybe you're not." My stomach twists up in a familiar gnarl of bad feelings. "But surely it's far more complex than that. He was part of my story. But he wasn't the cause of anything. You must understand that." She sounds quite firm, and just for a moment she's 16, and I'm 4, and she's Lynn, magical Lynn, who knows everything. "But he didn't exactly help." "Well, no. But you could say that of so many things, including my own personality quirks." Joss's eyes crease in that kind way she has. "It's hard for you. I know. It's all new. But I've been processing all these events for years." My eyes travel around the room, looking at the huge, flickering candles everywhere. Those candles cost a fortune. They're big ticket presents in southwest London. Yet she has 8 of them on the go. I've been sitting here for 15 minutes, and already I feel almost hypnotized by the scent. I feel soothed. I feel finally able to address the subject looming between us. "So, as I said in my email, I've read the whole thing now," I say slowly. "The new book?" "Yes," says Joss. And it's only one syllable, but I can hear the increased alertness in her voice and see how her head has tilted, like a bird's. "I think it's powerful. Empowering. No, I can't find the right word. I think I can see why you wanted to write it. I think women will read it and see how you can fall into a trap, and maybe it'll stop them falling into that trap." "Exactly," Joss leans forward, her eyes glowing intensely. Sylvie, I'm so glad you realize this is